The fifth plague with which the Lord judged the Egyptians was the first that directly affected their livelihoods. I was thinking about that truth. The first four plagues were devastating in their scope and their inescapability, but the effects of those plagues were confined to irritation and inconvenience. To have the water in the land turn to blood, to face the presence of frogs in every conceivable location, to see every grain of dust become a gnat or a louse, to hear the loud buzzing from hundreds of millions of flies, was to face massive problems. We dare not minimize any of those first four plagues. Each one made its presence felt and forced great misery on the people who lived in Egypt. But not until the fifth plague that caused the deaths of all the domesticated animals that were in the fields did the people of Egypt face the severe depletion of their food supplies. There is a lot of truth to the fact that the ancient Romans understood that if they could just keep their people fed, a lot of the other difficulties would tend to fade into the background. So the Romans understood that as long as there were plenty of holidays, plenty of bread and plenty of circuses with which to keep the people amused, that the people wouldn't have time to think about the wretched conditions of their lives. Well, once the Egyptians saw their livestock collapsing in the fields and reckoned that there would be less milk and less meat for everyone, then they started to see that this contest between the Pharaoh and Moses and Aaron evolved from the level of irritation to the level of deprivation. There would not be as much to eat and to drink. So by digging in his heels against the persistent calls from Moses and Aaron to let the children of Israel go, the Pharaoh was bringing devastation to the land and to the people who lived in it. And they could make the connection, as we will see in some of the subsequent plagues. But you think of it as the carcasses of the dead animals, cattle, sheep, horses, camels, donkeys, goats, any other domesticated animals, the carcasses lay rotting in the fields. And the stench of decaying flesh swept up and down the Nile River Valley and permeated every household and seeped into every square inch of fabric. There was nowhere you could go to get away from it. Not all the water of the Nile could wash that stench out of the clothing of the Egyptians. Not all the pronouncements of the Pharaoh could bring back the valuable food sources for the people of Egypt, who, after all, lived in a hostile environment. When the people of Egypt became aware, on top of that the children of Israel appeared to be without any such devastation, the misery of the Egyptians increased even more. To what end was the Pharaoh's policy toward the slaves taking the people of the previously proud kingdom and civilization? His policy was an exercise in stubborn depravity. God impelled the Pharaoh to act. Every person has to act. But he withheld the grace that Pharaoh needed to act wisely and humbly. And as the heaps of rotting flesh continued to fill the air with the stench of death, the people on both sides of the line received a memorable education in what happens to those who defy God. They confronted the inescapable reality of depravity's acrid remains. Depravity's acrid remains. Those who have occasion to travel across Interstate 8 from Gila Bend towards San Diego, and believe me, we have been over that road many times, become familiar with the stark beauty of the lower Sonora Desert. As the miles pass, those travelers cross three mountain ranges, two of them in Arizona, from east to west, in increasing degrees of ascent. The first of the ranges is 54 miles east of the line that separates Arizona from California. So when you reach that point, you have covered 60 miles from entering the freeway at Gila Bend, and the travelers who do so descend the other side of that ridge. The gentle slope, it is a gentle long slope, on the west side of that range into a broad valley. And as you travel along, you see more and more signs of agricultural business and activity, especially as you get closer to Yuma. Yuma is on the western side of the second range of mountains. The communities that occupy that broad valley between those two ranges have various names, but the most prominent, I suppose, is Tacna, about 40 miles east of the state line. When you're driving through that area, if the wind is blowing from the west or the north, you get the unmistakable evidence of the chief business in Tacna. It is cattle raising. I did not say cattle ranching because the cattle in that area spend their lives in feedlots. And the smells of the animals, and the muddy soil on which they stand, and that which they produce as a result of their constant eating combines to drench the landscape with an odor so powerful that as long as the travelers are in that area, unless they really want to smell it, they have to keep all their vents closed or hold their breaths. But as powerful as that smell can be, I assure you that it was nothing compared to the effects of the fifth plague in Egypt. Veterinarians in some parts of the world, especially those who deal with farm animals, know what it means to diagnose certain illnesses in the flocks and herds. Our brother Calvin grew up in cattle country in Nebraska, so he knows a little bit about diseases in farm animals, and he would know that certain diagnoses mean that the animals must be destroyed. Even the ones that haven't been yet infected have to be destroyed and burned. Well, in Egypt, the sudden deaths of so many animals was beyond dealing with them. Their carcasses simply remained in the fields where they fell, and they began to decompose quickly. We read earlier in connection with the plague of the frogs that when the frogs died, they gathered them into heaps and the land stank. Well, that was just the harbinger of the consequences of the plague of the marine. This judgment from God on the people of Egypt expounds for us the true end of stubborn refusal to obey the commands of God. And the thing that I would emphasize is that God does not need anything dramatic to bring a nation to its knees. We get this idea that there's got to be some major event. But God simply causes a virus or a bacteria to break out among the animals from whatever source, the animals that provide the food supply for the people, and the nation quickly lies devastated. These acrid remains served as an exposition of the course of divine judgment and the only way in which to escape. So there are three things that I would like you to consider in this passage this morning with me as we talk about the fifth plague. The first is the measure of the human will. The measure of the human will. We often hear people talk about how great the human will is. Well, the chapter that we have read opens with the renewal of the directive from the Lord through Moses and Aaron to Pharaoh. It was the same message that they had delivered before. Let my people go, that they may serve me. And the implication was clear. While they were in Egypt, they were serving Pharaoh. The Lord wanted them freed so that they could serve Him. Yet, we have already seen the evidence of the steadfast refusal of the Pharaoh to accede to this request. Notice the responses. Let's go back to chapter 5, first of all. Chapter 5 and verse 1. And afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, "Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast unto me in the wilderness." And Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I know not the Lord, neither will I let Israel go." So there's his first response. Who's the Lord? I don't know him. Now let's turn to chapter 7. Chapter 7, verse 16. "And thou shalt say unto him that is unto Pharaoh, the Lord God of the Hebrews hath sent me unto thee, saying, let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. And behold, hitherto thou wouldest not hear. Thus saith the Lord, in this thou shalt know that I am the Lord. Behold, I will smite with the rod that is in mine hand upon the waters which are in the river, and they shall be turned to blood." Verse 22. "And the magicians of Egypt did so with their enchantments, and Pharaoh's heart was hardened, neither did he hearken unto them, as the Lord had said. And Pharaoh turned and went into his house, neither did he set his heart to this also." That's a very striking expression. He did not set his heart to this. That is, Pharaoh's mind was already set. As a depraved man, he had nothing to think about. He was already on the course of action. Nothing to consider. Chapter 8, verse 15. This is in the aftermath of the plague of the frogs. When Pharaoh saw that there was respite, he hardened his heart and hearkened not unto them as the Lord had said. Verse 19, the plague of the lice or the gnats. Then the magician said unto Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. And Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he hearkened not unto them as the Lord had said. Chapter 8, verse 31. The plague of the flies. And the Lord did according to the word of Moses, and he removed the swarms of flies from Pharaoh, from his servants, and from his people. There remained not one. And Pharaoh hardened his heart at this time also, neither would he let the people go. Now we come into chapter 9 and verse 1, and we find the same request in that verse. And then in verse 2, we find the summation of the measure of the human will. Here is the acknowledgement. Pharaoh was refusing to let the people go, but now something is added to it in this verse. You will hold them still. We don't find that expression before. So now, there is not only the refusal to listen to the word of the Lord through Moses and Aaron, but also to set in place measures to ensure that the people don't get away by some deceitful means. He's going to hold them still. Here's the resolve of the Pharaoh. His attitude was, there was nothing anybody could say or do that would persuade him to let the Israelites go from their bondage. He was going to hold them whatever it took. Now, if you want to know how far the power of human depravity extends, here is the measure of it. You see, there are a lot of people who get the idea, and it's fostered by people in education and people in areas of philosophy, that people exist in some kind of moral equilibrium, that they're just naturally in a neutral place, and that the influences of their environment will determine in which direction they go, so that they may be induced toward doing that which is right if they only have the right influences in the environment. But the scriptures have the message that people do not do by nature what is good at all. We could go back and read the passage in Romans 3 again, where we find the categorical universal statements, there's none that doeth good, no, not one. When the Word of God wants to emphasize something, it's able to do so. There's none that doeth good. Then, in case you didn't get it, you didn't get the extent of that statement, no, not one, not even one. So those who speak of the nobility of the human will, of the free agency of man, have to face the scriptures that present the depraved will as being stubborn and determined to have its own way. Many years ago, before I ever entered seminary, the first serious work of theology I read was Luther's book, The Bondage of the Will. And it was a blockbuster. Luther, of course, in his inimitable style, had a way of impressing truth upon the mind. And what he argued was that depraved people are free if you understand what that freedom is. He said that they are free the way a cow is free and a horse is free. He said a cow is free to act as a cow. A horse is free to act as a horse. And a sinner is free to act as a sinner. And if God does not intervene to change the heart of someone who is a sinner, he will do what is wicked by nature and will refuse to be turned away from it. The Lord Jesus Christ presented a very powerful illustration of this very thing in the Gospel of Luke chapter 13. Luke chapter 13. Verse 34. The words of Christ. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, which killest the prophets and stonest them that are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together as a hen doth gather her brood under her wings, and ye would not. There's the summation of it. Jesus said, I would, ye would not. Here's the measure of the human will. So, Pharaoh said, I don't know the Lord. I'm not going to let the people go. I'm going to do all that is within my power to see to it that they stay right where they are. And the response by the Lord to this depraved resolve was to strike at the foundation of Egyptian life. And that brings me to the second thing that we find in the passage, the method of the divine judge. We come in the words of verse 3 to an expression that we don't find in the context of any of the other plagues. It is the expression, the hand of the Lord. Behold, the hand of the Lord is upon thy cattle, which is in the field. The hand of the Lord. Saying that the Lord, as it were by his own direct intervention, was going to bring this judgment to pass. Now, Moses and Aaron would not be using the rod. They would not be smiting anything. The Lord said his hand was upon the animals, and that he was going to cause among the animals that were in the field a grievous disease. And those animals we find listed here in verse 3, these are all the animals they needed for their economy, for their survival. Cattle being a general class, now we find it broken down into horses and asses and camels and oxen and sheep. Everything they needed was going to be afflicted by a grievous murrain. This word murrain is an expression that is still in use today. Although not many people are familiar with it, but those who are in the field of animal husbandry and veterinary science, they would know what murrain is. A murrain is a class of diseases that afflict animals that include things like anthrax, other diseases that afflict animals, something sudden, something overwhelming, that is an infection. And almost always the case is there's no remedy for it except to destroy the animals. Sometimes you read about a plague that afflicts chickens that are being raised for food or for eggs, and that when that diagnosis is made, the whole flock of chickens has to be destroyed. In the case of larger animals, whole herds have to be put down and burned because there's no answer for it. The animals get sick and die very quickly. And even if you could save one or two, you couldn't save all the rest. So we read here that all the cattle died that were in the field. You find that in verse 6. All the cattle of Egypt died. The ones that were in the field. We know that there were some that were not in the field that did not die, because if you look down at verse 19, you find that in a subsequent plague, Moses said, "Gather thy cattle and all that thou hast in the field." So these would be animals that were not killed in the previous plague. But apart from those animals that were not in the field, all the others died. Now I want you to think about it. There was no earthquake. There was no tornado. There was no hurricane. There was no flood. There was no Arctic storm, obviously, in Egypt. There was no act of war that brought this situation to pass. Suddenly, the animals that were at the heart of the Egyptian economy died. A lot of them. So that wherever you looked, you scanned around the area toward the horizon, you would see carcasses of horses and cows and sheep and camels and donkeys piled up everywhere, lying where they fell, rotting where they fell, and confronting the people of Egypt with the realization, these are animals that provided what we need to live. And before very long, the smell of death was everywhere. This situation was becoming serious. The irritations of the previous plagues were nothing compared to this. Now it meant they wouldn't have as much to eat. And they wouldn't have the animals they needed to till the fields, to do the plowing that was needed. God's judgment was wreaking a terrible harvest in the land. But there is a third thing in the passage that is most astonishing, and that is the manner of the redeemed people. And here I want to focus on the words that we find in verse 4. The Lord shall sever between the cattle of Israel and the cattle of Egypt, and there shall nothing die of all that is the children's of Israel. And at the end of verse 6, you find the statement of the cattle of the children of Israel died not one. Not even one of their animals that they had in the field, not even one of them died. Not even one by some chance illness or some other cause died. None of them. So that God was demonstrating again, as he did in the plague of the flies, that he had the capacity to separate between his people and the people of Egypt so that the plague would not affect his people. So that the land of Goshen, that was the land where the Israelites lived, it was not what the Egyptians would consider a desirable place, but it was where the Israelites lived. And it was separated by geographic boundaries from the rest of the land. So they were there, and that land, none of the animals died. Here was the rest of Egypt, all up and down the Nile River Valley, and the animals dropped dead everywhere. But in the land of Goshen, not one. the people of Israel went about their lives normally. There was no consternation that they were losing their food supply or the labor of their working animals. God severed between them. He delivered them from the judgment that he brought to the Egyptians. And what was the reason? Because they were his people. He redeemed them. They were people that he had set apart for himself. There were promises that were made to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And these were their descendants. These were God's people. He marked them off and set them apart by the power of redemption, as would continue to be the case in the subsequent plagues, leading to that ultimate separation in the plague of the death of the firstborn. So he marked off his people to save them from the judgment. And what was the response of Pharaoh when he got the news of this separation? We find in verse 7 that he sent, and behold, there was not one of the cattle of the Israelites dead. Now you would think, would you not, that he would say, all right, this has gone far enough. I understand now that the Lord is doing this. We would think that, but Pharaoh did not think that. Nor would anyone else think that who reasoned as he reasoned in a depraved and stubborn manner. He sent to find the news, and when he heard the news, it made him angrier than ever. It made him more determined than ever. And so we read at the end of verse 7, the heart of Pharaoh was hardened, and he did not let the people go. God impelled him to act. Pharaoh had to do something. God did not show his grace to him, so Pharaoh acted as he wished, as he desired. The Israelites were spared. The redeemed people were delivered. But Pharaoh went on. He went on, determined to have his way. And ultimately it would lead to such devastations that the people would say, the whole country is destroyed. Let the people go. The whole country is destroyed. And then ultimately would arise the cry on that night when in every house there was at least one dead. What is the message that comes from the acrid remains of the animals rotting in the field? The message is, you cannot insist on your way in the face of God. God brings his purposes to pass. It was his purpose to liberate his people from their bondage in Egypt, and he was going to bring that to pass. He even said of Pharaoh, I raised him up for this very purpose, to show my glory over him. It is a reminder to us that the Lord has said of his people, he will preserve them. He will protect them. We live in an age in which there is much pressure being applied against the people of God. It ought not to surprise us. It is nothing different from the rest of the history of the church. And who knows what we will see as the time goes by, as the Lord does not come. Who knows what God's purposes are? But we know what his purpose is in this regard, that he will preserve his people. He will defend their cause. And that he has the power to humble the most depraved and wicked ruler, as he did in the case of Pharaoh, the most powerful figure in the world at that time. He humbled him, brought down him and the people who served him. And ultimately, God glorified himself in the deliverance of his people. The judgments of God, they are real judgments. The people of Egypt felt them as such. So the judgments of God that are abroad in the world today are real judgments. And whether people acknowledge their source or not, they feel the effects of them and will continue to do so. Let us then resolve that we will repair to the purposes of our God. As the children of Israel, they simply went about their lives as they did day by day. They weren't cowering in fear. They knew that God's purpose was to redeem them and to deliver them. And whatever, however that would develop, they resolved that they would continue on to serve the one true God.